Welcome to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. This podcast is for those who are committed to thriving no matter where they are in that journey. And I say journey because thriving is not about achievement. It is not a destination. It is about engagement. When we feel energized by our life and we feel at our very best. My name is Bobby Kaler and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to be on this journey with you. I mentioned that it's a journey and you might find yourself anywhere along that path. You may be starting out. You may be moving up within an organization. You might be an entrepreneur, a business owner, a salesperson, or self-employed. Or you just might be that person who feels like there's something calling to you and it's time for a change. My mission is to provide stories that inspire us so that when the specter of doubt darkens our doorway, and it always shows up at the absolute worst time, we will choose to persist. I will also provide practical skills, perspectives, and ideas that will help us create the habits of thriving and flourishing. This is about providing hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. Let's get right to today's episode. My guest today is Tony Bond, and he is super accomplished. He is the Executive Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer of Great Place to Work, the global research and analytics firm that produces the annual Fortune 100 Best Companies to Work For list, the World's Best Workplaces list, the 100 Best Workplace for Women list, the Best Workplaces for Diversity list, and dozens of other distinguished workplace rankings around the world. Tony has served as a trusted advisor for executives at some of the most successful global organizations, including the National Basketball Association, AT&T, Coca-Cola, Whole Foods, and American Express. As you will hear in the conversation, he is adept at leadership and personal transformation, and I can't wait for you to meet him. So, Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bobby. It's great to be here.
Well, hey, I'm so glad that you are. And I was thinking about, we first met back in October of 2008 when we entered grad school together at Case Western. And the thing I remember about you maybe the most is that, and I know I've shared this with you, but every time you spoke up in class, like I know I leaned forward and I think maybe everyone else did as well, because whenever you spoke, like you just had pearls of wisdom all the time. So everyone wanted to hear what you had to say.
Wow. Yeah, I was so totally shocked when you mentioned that. I thought, yeah, no one even heard anything that I said.
Oh, man. No, Tony, everybody wanted to.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So now I just know a little bit about your story, but that made me think that you would just be a great guest on the podcast. So thanks again for being here.
Absolutely.
Okay. So speaking of your story, I know that you have a super cool job now. And that you're launching a nonprofit. I think the both of those are exciting. But before we get to that, I also wanted to know more. I know that you've had some transitions and crossroads in your journey. And I was wondering if you'd kind of fill us in on some of those.
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So I'll start from the very beginning. So I'm the youngest of four. And when I was born, our father was ill. He had sort of an occupational exposure to some chemicals. And he had what I believe it's considered silicosis, which damages your lungs and other body parts. And so I never knew him as someone who was well. So from the time that I was one, he was extremely ill up until he lived until I was 17 years old. But because of that, it created this environment where there was always uncertainty. We weren't sure if he would live another day or if we'd have to take him somewhere else to be treated. And so my mother was pouring tons of attention into him. My siblings were a little bit older, so it was always that just kind of a period of uncertainty. So it started very early on, and I've always found myself, you know, being in the midst of change, and you eventually grow quite comfortable with change. But that was sort of growing up, and then I always had these aspirations of being a professional athlete. My first sport of choice was actually football.
And really?
The junior year before my senior year. Was getting exposure, getting some great looks, and then I was hit by a car just riding on my bicycle. and it injured my knee, caused me to miss my last year of football. I was able to recover and be okay, but that dream sort of went away. And so I ended up playing college basketball. So I think from the time I was born until I actually went to college, it felt like things were always happening that made me pivot and have to change course. But then I started a career, and I've had a couple of career changes. I think it sort of falls into three phases, you know, early career. And then I had a career that I was with quite some time. And then when you met me, I was in a transitional period of going from a corporate career to not quite what I'm doing now, but on the journey to what I'm doing now.
Yeah. So Tony, I didn't know that about your dad. I didn't know that he was sick like your entire childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was sick. He was given 1 year to live, the year that I was born, but he ended up living 17 years. And it wasn't, a beautiful way of living, but we were happy that he was around that long.
Yeah. So I imagine like with your dad being sick, and you said that your mother had to pour so much into him. And how much older were your siblings than you are?
Yeah, my oldest brother is around 8 years older. The one that's closest to me, he's 3 years older.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you kids kind of like help take care of each other, or how did that play out?
Yeah, I think my oldest brother was sort of like a father. And so
yeah,
I saw him as kind of being a father figure to us. And we did have other family members around. So my grandmother in the town and some others. And so I never had any moments where I didn't, you know, have what I needed, but it's not like having your father there to do things with you, but
yeah.
I've looked back on it as being fairly comfortable in a caring environment, but still other things were missing. That's important when you're growing up in that age.
Yep. My mom, she was one of seven. And this was back, she was born in 1937. And she was 3 years old, and her father had stopped to help a stranded motorist, and he was hit and killed by a drunk driver. Mm. And I mean, she was the second from the youngest, and it just completely affects your childhood that way. I mean, in her case, he wasn't around at all. And then her mom had to work, and it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you don't realize until you get a little bit older, the adjustments it requires. And
but
we get through it.
That's right. And now I know that you had told me before when you were, I think your dad was in the hospital, and mm-hmm. you could hear the roar of the crowd outside, I think playing football, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was spent a lot of time in a university hospital, and I always dreamed of playing, you know, college football and then maybe professional football. And so on a Saturday I didn't go visit a lot, but the few times I do remember hearing the crowd and having a goal of one day I'm going to play there. And that dream was sort of materializing, believe it or not, but because of the knee injury and some other stuff from, you know, the car situation, I ended up having to let go of that dream and really stick with basketball.
Yeah. And you said many times you've had to pivot. That had to be hard to let go of that dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really hard. And I was a really introverted kid at the time. I think maybe in the course of a school year, I may have said one or two words. And so I was pretty much doing things on my own, like learning how to do things on my own. And I didn't really have a lot of people around me who knew sports really well. And so it was like no one there to really lean on. And I was making these decisions. And so it was challenging, but I was fortunate. I mean, I had a scholarship to play basketball, and that worked out okay. So, and I met my wife because of that. So
that's great.
It all
great,
worked
then.
Out. Yeah, yeah. It ended up being a benefit.
And now you've got kids and you've got a grandchild. So mm-hmm. I guess things work out the way maybe they're meant to.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things I learned really early is having some uncertainty in the home environment is that I dreamed a lot. Like, it's kind of hard to be in the moment at times. And so I would always dream a lot about what I wanted to do and gain some clarity around things, but didn't have a lot of certainty of how to get there, but had some clarity around what did I wanted to do and who I wanted to be. And that's always kind of been my mode of operating, try to have as much clarity as possible. Without having a lot of certainty of how to do it, just seek clarity.
That's tough to do, you know, without mm-hmm. the certainty. So how have you developed that clarity for yourself?
I think for reflection, I think naturally being a strong introvert, I spend a lot of time thinking and reflecting. And I try to take things as learning opportunities. So I'll sort of plan to do something and I'll do it. And then I'll spend some time reflecting on it. How did it work for me? And how did I show up? What did I learn from it? And I think all of that helped me gather a deep understanding of who I am as a person pretty early on. And once you know who you are, I think everything else becomes fairly clear.
Yeah.
For you.
It really becomes a guide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I really hear what you're saying about being the introvert. And, you know, I've been accused a lot of maybe thinking too much, and that's probably fair, because I spend a lot of time in my head thinking about things, when something happens, how did I contribute to it? What could I do differently? So that really resonates with me, what you're talking about there.
Yeah. I think there's a shadow side. Sometimes I do too much of it. And so it keeps you from really enjoying the moment, living life versus analyzing your life. But a healthy amount of that, I feel like, has been very beneficial to me.
Yeah. So is that something that you still do today?
I still do. Yeah. My wife and I take walks every morning. Sometimes we run together. Sometimes we'll interact and talk. And sometimes it's just thinking and being together. I also try to carve out moments during the day where I'm not connected to any technology. I'm not reading anything. Some may say it's wasting time, but for me, it's more of just dreaming and thinking. And I think that just puts me in a place where the things I have to do, I can do them so much more effectively and creatively when I can find that space.
Yeah.
And then I have mindfulness practice. I try to, wake up and do, have the Calm app that I do, not every morning, but a great deal of the week. And so it kind of comes naturally, I guess, for me.
Yeah.
Again, being an introvert. Yeah.
That's right. What's the app again?
It's called Calm. It's Calm.
Wow. And yes. So give me an idea of what, like, how long does it take? What's it like?
It's an app and it has a different focus every single day. It takes about 15 minutes and it just basically moves from a place of getting yourself centered, kind of maybe doing a body scan.
Yeah.
And then the person will actually introduce a topic. So it's very, very peaceful with some nice background music and nature sounds in the background. So I strongly recommend. It's not a commercial, but it works for me. So I strongly recommend it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I found one. It was a meditation thing. And sometimes I have trouble sitting still, and then I worry about, oh my God, my mind's wandering. I'm not doing this right. So then I start to feel stressed when I'm trying to meditate, which is counterproductive. But I found one and it is a guided meditation for when you're out for a walk. That was really cool. And what I find myself is like, I love cross country skiing and to be out with the sound of nature. And sometimes I'll just think about some of those activities from that, the guided meditation. And, it's just nice. It's nice to give your mind, I guess, the white space to calm down.
Yeah, it really is. It can become a little too busy at times. Yeah.
Yeah. I really think lack of margin, it's really detrimental to being, as effective as we could be.
Yeah, I would totally agree.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more. So you made the transition to basketball. How'd basketball work out for you?
It worked out really well. Well, I would say our kids played college basketball. My wife played college basketball.
Wow.
So it's something we've all done. And there are valleys, highs and lows associated with sports.
Yeah.
And when you get to the college level, it's even more intense. So I unfortunately continued to have injuries, even going into college. And so it's a sport where if you're competing and you're a part of things, it's one experience. And if you're injured, it's a totally different experience. You're somewhat disconnected. And so I went in and out of those periods where I was really connected and totally disconnected, which is kind of hard, but had some great teammates, They are my closest friends still today. Learned a lot from coaches. So that's been pretty much my whole life story is being coached. And even in the professional world, I've had, life coaches, I've had executive coaches help me. So I'm very, very big on coaching. I think that's also been a really a benefit to my
Like a
own
real constant.
development, a real constant thing.
So, Tony, one of the things that I've noticed too is I think that when people play sports at a competitive level, I think that there's lessons that you learn that I think carry over to other parts of your life. Is that what you, I mean, because you've played at that level, is that what you found as well?
I have found that. I mentioned that this periods of being injured, you find ways of coping with trauma or coming back from, letdowns and finding a way of continuing to be positive. You also learn a lot about how to think strategically. You learn a lot about how to interact with other people. So I feel like your social toolkit that you take out of playing with sports is pretty deep. And it helps you in a lot of different situations. And it also, you're always very much striving towards a goal. And so because of that, you're very focused on how to make the best use of your time and resources. So I would agree. I mean, I think it's a wonderful experience. Even beyond all of the sort of letdowns and trials and tribulations, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
So speaking of the, coming back from a letdown, or I mean, because you can't win every game, right? As much as we want to. And and coming back from injuries, what were some of the things that you learned as far as bouncing back?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I learned the power, and I learned this later on because I was kind of a one-man show and did a lot of things on my own. But I learned the value and the importance of community and how you can do anything so much better if you have that supporting group around you. In college and in basketball, it was my teammates. I mean, that was my community. And we supported each other through almost anything. And then once I got into the workplace, force, I realized that that's still important. Have a community of people. It doesn't have to be a broad community, but if you have people that really have similar values, see the world as you do, but also differently, I think that's helped me. So I've been able to not just lean on my own intuition and ways of doing things, but have pe other people help me along the way.
I think it's really important, and if you're on a team, I think, your community's kind of there. I think, my husband and I, we've moved a lot in our 20, 21 years together. And sometimes that's the piece that's hard. It's like, 'cause both of us are self-employed and, so you don't go to work. And you move around a lot. It's like, how do you create a community for yourself if it's not already there? That can be a big challenge.
Can be a huge challenge. And I think the other thing is, and I wasn't familiar with this term, but I don't know if you've heard of Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan priest out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he
No.
has what's called the Center for Action and Contemplation. But he is he's been very influential in my life as well. And one of the things he says is kind of this belief that everything belongs. And so when I look back on some of the transitions and some of the losses that occurred and having to pivot, if I could just see it as this belongs, I may not know why right now, and I may not know how it fits in the long term, but it's a part of the overall journey. And I think just a belief system like that helps you with having self-efficacy and just feeling like you can persevere and move on.
I love that. Everything belongs.
And how I got to where I am today, there was no straight path. I mean, if you had told me I would be doing what I do today, I would have probably laughed hysterically because it wasn't a part of the plan, but it was kind of just a journey that I was on. that got me to this point. And now I can look back and see that at those moments, it was really important that those things happen, around me and to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Right. So tell us a little bit more about that.
When I went to college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to major in. I majored in psychology, but I took a lot of kind of liberal arts courses. I like to write and read and all those other things. And so my plan at the time is I thought maybe I'll be a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I wasn't sure between the two. So I had a chance after I graduated to work at a psychiatric hospital. And I'm thinking, this is it. And
wow.
But without knowing a whole lot about it. And so I remember one summer, I was making rounds for a doctor. There was one patient who I got to know fairly well. She was probably 30 at the time, and I was 22. And she was complaining of these headaches that wouldn't go away. And they were basically diagnosing it as kind of a psychosomatic illness. So there was nothing like physically wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know her through conversations, and she was like, no, there's something seriously wrong with me. And so, make a long story short, I was making rounds one weekend. I think it was a Friday night. And I walked into her room, and she was unresponsive.
Oh, no.
And so she wasn't living. And so what had happened was there was a tumor on the stem of her brain or something that caused her to pass, and it couldn't be detected. And so there was no way that anyone would have known. But I quickly realized this job is serious. It's like you have lives in your hands. I don't know if I'm ready for that as a 22-year-old. So I decided, no, I'm not going to pursue that. But the experience I had, the training in psychology and undergrad, and just the time that I spent with patients having those conversations, if I think about what I do today and being totally present with people and having a sense of empathy, it was during that period of time that I really started to develop those things. And so it wasn't meant to be my long-term way of making money or my long-term career, but it's been so valuable to what I do today. So that was one part. And then I got into the corporate world, and I was working in the financial services industry, and I had a chance to spend time in operations, accounting, marketing, finance. Most of my time was in corporate finance. So I got unbelievable training, exposure across the organization. It never really felt like it was my passion, but it was a great company, and I learned a lot. And if I think about what I do today, and after leaving there, I started my own business. If I didn't have those skills that I had developed through that corporate career, it probably wouldn't have allowed me to do what I had chosen to do when you met me.
Right.
And then going to Case kind of opened up my eyes, Case Western, because I had no intention of working in the HR space, knew nothing about
really?
HR. Yeah. Someone convinced me, because I had gone while I was in corporate, for my MBA, only because it made sense for what I was doing. And I decided I want to pursue education. I'm not sure what I want to do. And someone told me about the CASE program. And it was like my first time of being exposed to organizational development, human resources. And I really enjoyed it. And that experience sort of put me into what I'm doing today. So it wasn't a straight line. It was very much a curves in the path. But as Richard Rohr would say, everything belonged when I look back on it.
That's right. That's right. And I have to ask you one question, and then I want to know more about what you are doing today.
Okay.
I think you told me, was it before going to Case that you went on the retreat in the desert?
Mm-hmm. That was a part of a sort of Center for Action and Contemplation. I left my corporate job and decided to start a business of my own during the recession. Not the smartest idea, but I'm thinking, there probably aren't a lot of people doing it, so it probably is a good time. And so
that's right.
But my mother was dying of cancer, and I had a chance to just not work and be with her for like the last 6 or 7 months of her life. And then once she passed, I engaged in what's called men's rites of passage. And it's kind of an initiation based on kind of native traditions of vision quests and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I went to Arizona, spent a week in the desert, unplugged from everyone, going through some rituals. And the whole idea is you leave your community, you go through initiations, and you go back to your community just a better person. And so it was through that process that I started to get more clarity around what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. So that was before I got to Case Western.
Wow. Now, were you by yourself for that week, or were there other people around, or was it a mixture?
There are other men around, but you wake up in the morning, you do some things as a group, and then you sort of set off in the desert by yourself. And
wow.
There's a lot of like drawing a circle in the desert, sitting in that circle, and just being with yourself and being with nature. Being in the midst of, we had some downpours and hail coming down, so it was really interesting. So yeah, that was great. And so then I ended up starting Case Western and learning more about organizational development and learning more about sustainability, if you remember Chris Laszlo.
That's right.
And so that was sort of the thing that really pulled at me. And so left the Case experience and started consulting practice focused on kind of a mixture of OD and sustainability work.
And then now you are, tell us what you're doing now.
Now I work for a Great Place to Work, which is really a name of a company.
You're not just bragging.
Not just bragging. Yeah, we are based in Oakland, California. It's been around for over 30 years. And so if I had to describe who are we are a HR tech company. So we have this unbelievable SaaS platform that helps us gather data on the employee experience and what it's like for all employees, with the idea that we want to make it a great place to work for everyone. And we use the data to influence some of the actions, behaviors, and decisions that executives and leaders are making in organizations. We also recognize those companies who are doing a great job of creating a great place to work for all. And one of the ways we do that is in partnership with Fortune magazine. So if you see the 100 best companies to work for,
yeah,
published in Fortune, that's based on the data and research that we pull together. So it's really focused on kind of the human side of sustainability is the way I see
it. Yeah.
And part of the reason, I think what kind of got me there, part of the interest I had was doing the sustainability work on the other side. And I remember having conversations with Chris Laszlo, and it's like, companies doing a great job around the environment, more green ways of working. They're also doing a lot of great community type work, but would you want your family members to work there? What's the culture like? And it felt like, you know what? There has to be someone focused on sustainability from a culture perspective in organizations. And lo and behold, there was a company. It's called Great Place to Work.
Yeah. So you just reached out, or how did you get connected?
No, actually, it was weird. Someone from Case, who I didn't know through Case, but also a Case alumni, reached out to me to see if I knew anyone who would be interested in working in this organization. And as I got to learn more about it, they were starting to ask me if I would be interested. And I'm like, well, actually, I'm in the kind of the sustainability field. And they sort of helped me see this is sustainability. This is kind of the human side. And so it went from looking for others to bring there to me being a part of it, which I'm very thankful for that reach out.
Yeah, that is so cool. And I'm curious, Tony, I love how you put that, the sustainability on the human side. What are some of the things that in your experience you've learned that need to be there for that kind of sustainability when it comes to people?
Yeah, I think it kind of falls to our model and methodology. And so we look at what creates a great place to work is you have these three really strong relationships. The first one is the relationship that the employee has with leadership. And are leaders credible? Are they able to make the right decisions? Do they create an environment where there's a sense of fairness? And then do they respect the employee and what the employee has to bring to the organization? So that creates that sense of trust. And then also, is it a place where I feel like the people that I work with just a strong sense of camaraderie? You know, we want to be together, we support each other. And then the last relationship we look at is the relationship people have with the work that they do. So it's more than a job, but it brings a sense of purpose. People are really totally aligned with the mission. So if you bring those three relationships together, that's really what creates a great place to work. And I think that's what creates or gives you a great idea of how to build a human side of sustainability within an organization.
You know, when you were talking there, Tony, what occurred to me is that applies not just in a workplace, but like at home and a family, you know, a community. I mean, it really does transcend. What do you think? It seems like it transcends it though.
Yeah, I agree. It has applications across different types of organizations, nonprofits, families, communities, I would say.
Yeah.
So it's,
I love that.
It was, I think the founder was well ahead of the times when they came up with this whole idea. And it's one of those stories where a book became a company eventually. And we've been doing this for a long time.
That's right. That's really cool. So that must be, that must be very rewarding work. I mean, hard, but rewarding.
Yeah, it's hard because you're dealing with behavioral change in a lot of cases. And now that we have some of the things that are happening in the larger world, the outside landscape is changing, and there's a lot of attention on race and racial injustice. And so that's a big part. Organizations are not immune from what's going on in the community.
No.
And truly, it sort of represents the community. And so we're having to help companies address some of those really difficult things and have the difficult conversations right now.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm hearing there, Tony, is that, and I know you're aware of this, but it's really standing out to me is how everything that you've learned throughout your life, whether it was from your childhood, playing sports, I mean, your early focus on psychology, everything belongs, right? Everything is showing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, Bobby. I'll give you an example. We're having these sessions internally at our organization, and we're trying to just start the conversation around race and, you know, what does it mean to all of us? And we're just really doing it right now to listen to hear. We're not trying to listen to respond, but at first we need to listen to just really hear. That comes a little bit easier for me because my father was very much like that. He was like big on economy of words, and he would ask a few questions and he would just listen. And so he encouraged us to be the same way, you know, listen way more than you're talking. And don't jump into the conversation unless you're going to say something that shifts it in a certain way. If you're just like piling onto it, you don't say anything. So that was kind of how I was raised. And then I was also raised to be a bit more towards action. Like the question would be, are we talking about doing or are we actually doing? And so I would bring things to my brother, who was older than me, issues I'm having in school, and he would always ask me, what are you going to do about it? And so it's like, it's like, I guess I can't complain. I have to figure out what I'm going to do. So when it comes to,
I think that's what big brothers are for.
Right? Yeah. So when it comes to this whole diversity, equity, inclusion conversation, I'm more towards the side of what can I actually, I want to listen and hear, but then I want to get to a place where I'm actually doing things and not necessarily talking about the things that need to get done. So that, that was helpful. Just having an upbringing like that has helped me.
That's amazing that what you learned from your father. And I love that around listening to really hear, because I think that to your point earlier, so many times, well, and Stephen Covey talked about this, right? I think it was in Seven Habits that when we're listening, we're listening to respond. We're not listening to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can just make that, that's something that I teach all the time in the work I do. Like when we really listen to really understand, it can be powerful. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to go back to something you said there too, is, you know, the doing part of it. And I know that, is that maybe where your nonprofit's coming in?
Yeah, so it's nonprofit, which this is kind of a recent thing. And I'm working with others because I have a daytime job. It keeps me pretty busy, but I have I do have connections. And so one day I was reflecting back on my sport experience. And we had a son way better than me in basketball. Our daughter was way better than my wife in basketball. And so if anyone had the opportunity to be a pro, it would probably was going to be our son. And so he had some unfortunate injuries and other things. And so because of my journey, my wife's journey, our son's journey, it was almost like I didn't want to be around sports. I didn't want to be around basketball anymore. It's like, I've had enough, you know, It's bad enough for me to have dreams cut short, but then to have your kids go through the same, that's kind of,
That's painful.
it's painful. And so I read this book. It's by Nilufer Fru Merchant, and it's called The Power of Onlyness. I think it's
Yeah.
Make Your Wild Ideas Mighty Enough to Dent the World. And that book really helped me understand how, because of your experience and because of what I went through, there's probably no one else in the world who's uniquely qualified to make a dent in that area that I'm trying to stay away from, and I'm trying to like not be a part of anymore. And so then I started to think, I have this knowledge, I have these connections, I've coached a lot of kids in basketball. Some are professional athletes now. And on the work side, I've spent a lifetime in corporate. I have a lot of corporate connections. Fortunately, thankfully, a lot of them are at the top of the organization. One of the things I know is that there's injustices in sports, especially in the major college sports and the big universities. Black male athletes' experience is totally different than anyone else. They graduate at a rate that's lower than others. I would say they're probably more of a mismatch in careers, either underemployed or have a difficult time finding employment. A lot of them are first-generation college students. A lot of them come from single-parent households, and they commit so much to the sport that they can't do
Yeah.
internships, they can't have work experience, they don't have the social. Why not do something about it and make these connections between the two? So the whole idea is there's a lot you learn in sport that's really tacit knowledge or knowledge that doesn't really show up. It's hard to see, but
That's right.
you're gaining it through the experience. And there's so many competencies on the corporate side that you're looking for. There's got to be a match. And so we're trying to create a shared language so that it makes it easier for the athletes to see how what they're doing matches careers. It helps the hiring managers better understand the implicit skills that athletes bring. So it's almost creating this shared language. And that language could become some sort of an algorithm that starts to match opportunities. So
Yeah.
that's where we are right now.
That is really cool.
So we've given it a project name. It's called Halo, Helping Athletes Land Opportunities. And
Nice.
on weekends, sometimes on evenings, I'll spend a little bit of time around this. But fortunately, again, I have a community of people that really like the idea and are starting to help make it a reality.
Yeah. It's getting enough people involved, you know. What a great and I love the name. That is awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. We're playing with it. It's a Halo project right now. And that's what
Okay.
the power of onlyness is really about, finding your tribe. So while you may have that unique experience that no one else has, there are other people who have a similar story. And if you can find those people, and together you can really make a dent in the world. So
Yeah. Well,
that's
I
the
know
idea.
that is cool because you told me about that book when we spoke. I think it was last Friday, and I downloaded it, so I started reading it because I'm like, well, if Tony says it's good, I'm reading it.
It's hopefully you enjoy it. It's been a really, I love reading, but that's one of when you talk about pivots and what's kind of helped me get to
Yeah.
this place, that was very instrumental.
Very cool. And with that too, I think that's a good kind of a good segue. What, and we've talked about so many great things already. Is there anything else that has helped you really to get to where you are now that we haven't covered?
It's a great question. I think a belief, like a faith. I have a strong belief in myself, and I have strong faith in myself and others. And so I see the world as being overall a great place, and I see people overall as being great people. And so I believe just having that view of the world and having that view of others, sometimes it's hard to kind of see it that way today. But overall, I have a deep belief that there's good in the world and there's good in people,
Yeah.
which forces me to get to know people that are a little bit different than me. And I think that's been the beauty of having community of people who, it almost is kind of a ragtag group of people. When you look at it, it's like, why are they together? And some may be musicians or artists. farmers, people of all different walks of life. And I think that's the sort of community that I've intentionally tried to build for myself. And I think that's been huge for me. And it starts with a really small group, but you find that even within that small group, the reach becomes pretty broad because they're in different worlds than I am. And it creates so many different connections to so many different people. So we talked about community, but that's just a little bit more of the nuance around how I see community.
Yeah. That kind of,
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
And I was going to say, then the thirst for learning. I'm super curious.
Yeah.
And want to learn. And I gave up. My siblings are all musicians, piano, guitar, trumpet, you name it. My mother played the piano, but I sort of gave up being a drummer early because I wanted to pursue sports. And maybe a year or two ago, I felt like, I need to learn the guitar because my brothers both play the guitar. And so I started guitar lessons, and
oh my goodness,
it was really difficult at the very beginning. I thought I would be horrible, but I'm starting to learn chord progression, and it's all come together, and I have some songs I can play. So I'm amazed. I think that's helped me in the work that I do, just the fact of taking guitar lessons.
Yeah. How has it helped you in the work that you do? I'm curious.
I think it's a big part of the teacher that I have. And so the teacher, he spent a lifetime of music. He's educated in music. And so he's not only teaching me chords and teaching me songs, but he's teaching me the history behind it. And one day I accidentally moved my finger in the wrong position on the wrong fret, and I just strummed the strings, and it was a chord, but I'd never played it before. And I smiled, and he's like, "Why are you smiling?" And I'm like, "That sounded familiar to me." He's like, "Yeah, that's, Laurel Canyon in California, when a lot of the rock groups were getting together." He said, "That's the chord that Joni Mitchell plays on a lot of her songs." And immediately I can make a connection to Joni Mitchell and that one mistake that I had made. So what am I learning in the workplace? I'm just learning. I've always been a systems thinker, but I'm putting things together a little bit better now. When I think about D&I, I'm starting to be more interested and more curious about some of the history and how we got to this place. And I think he's helped me be that person who's very interested in history a little bit more because of how he's teaching me music through history.
Yeah. God, it's fascinating to me just by jumping into something new. You just don't know what's going to open up, what new world or what new learning or I think about, I took cross-country skiing lessons. It was about 10 years ago. And on the surface, they go, okay, well, it's a lesson on how to cross-country ski. But I learned so much about myself and what it takes to learn something when you're afraid. And it was interesting to me how it translated into other parts of my life. Something so simple.
So true. I think the older I get, the little bit more risk adverse I may become. And it's simply having to learn some chords and play it in front of someone and perform, it makes me nervous. And I think that's healthy because it enables me to be a little bit more creative in other things that I'm doing and not afraid of making mistakes.
That is a great point. So what's your favorite song that you play?
I think it's some of the classic rock songs. So I'm learning, I'm still learning, but I like a lot of the Eagles music.
Okay.
I like some of the old rhythm and blues songs, whether it's Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Oh, what a great song.
It's an easy one to play. There's only a few chords and, people can sing along, you can strum. I'm not quite where my brothers are. They can play quite a bit. So I'm keeping it fairly simple right now.
Very good. Fairly simple. Oh my gosh. I took guitar lessons as a kid and I never got to anything that good. So
really?
You're way beyond what I could do. And yeah. I'm so curious about something. I want to go back to when you were talking about community, because you're someone, you've been really intentional with that. If someone wanted to learn more about that, like how do they go about that? Or, to build that community for themselves, what advice would you have for that?
Yeah, that's really good. Great question. I would say, first of all, Know that everyone has a story. And when I recognize they have a story, I automatically feel closer to that person because, you know, people's stories are powerful. And so when you meet people or you interact with people, try as best as you can to hear a little bit about their story. And my wife always asks, you know, she used to tell me in college, you should say more about yourself. You should tell people more about yourself. And I never did. I always love hearing about other people. And so I think when you hear those stories, it gets you closer. You find common connections, and you ultimately find yourself as a part of a community. And I've also looked for ways, like I've done in New Mexico, I've stayed on a Lakota reservation for a week. And you go there and you know no one, but you immediately build community because the day starts with interpreting dreams. And so you'll sit in a circle and the elder will actually have people go around and share what the dream you had the night before involved. And then this person would interpret your dream. And just sitting there hearing your dream being interpreted, hearing other people's dreams being interpreted was like amazing. And I had a chance to do this maybe 6 years ago. So I also look for how can I sort of put myself in a place where I'm maybe the only one like me. And it's fearful at the very beginning, but then at the end of the week, I realize how powerful of a community I've just built with people who I didn't know and felt like I had nothing in common with. Those experiences just helped me value community much more.
Yeah, that is so cool. You know, and I completely resonates with me that everyone has a story, you know,
mm-hmm.
we all do. I'll never forget this one time. This is when I lived in Portland. So well before I knew you, I was coming home. It was a Friday night. I'd had a massage and I was driving home and I was on the exit ramp. Mm-hmm. And it was where, you know, the two lanes come down into one and no, it was rush hour and it was backed up. And there's out of the corner of my eye, I saw this woman over to my side and she was on the shoulder and she's trying to pass people. And, you know, instantly you think, oh, what is this woman doing? You know? Mm-hmm. And then I looked over and I saw her and she was completely sobbing. And that's when it occurred to me, Tony, what was at the end of the exit ramp? A hospital. What's the chance she was trying to get there? And it really just hit me like we see actions and we just judge them so quickly. And yet if we take the time to see maybe behind a little bit at the story, I mean, I don't know, maybe she was faking it, but I want to believe she was trying to get to the hospital and it completely changed the way I felt about her and her actions. And that's never left me, that experience.
Yeah. That's a great, great example. That's so true.
Yeah.
And another thing I'll share with you, it's like when you and I spoke, I think it was last week, and we just mm-hmm. kind of exchanged some of the things about our upbringing and, you know, how it was when we were young. And I had no idea. I would have never known or could have guessed, you know, how there's some similarities in our upbringing as far as, you know, family dynamics. And so I knew you. I already felt close to you, but now I feel even closer just because of hearing a little bit more about your story. So I think, I don't know, maybe that's a great way for us to build community is
see and
hear the stories of others.
Yeah. It's so funny. And thank you for saying that, Tony. It was so funny because when I got off the phone with you last week, I went downstairs and I told my husband, I'm like, wow, Tony was always one of my favorite people. And I feel so much closer to him now. You know, it wasn't like we're on the phone for 5 hours. It was a relatively short call.
Yeah. So, same here.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And Tony, this has been just fabulous. So much good stuff. If people want to learn more about you, what you're doing, your nonprofit, what's the best way for them to learn more and get in touch with you?
Yeah. So the best way is, I'm on at Tony Bond on Twitter. But I don't use that a whole lot, believe it or not. So I think probably my email, I'll share it. It's Tony and it's 2 D's, Tony DD Bond @gmail. It's a great way to reach me. It won't get lost in all of my work emails.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's what, and then I'm on LinkedIn. You can actually connect with me on LinkedIn. That's a great way as well.
Perfect. And I'll make sure I put that in the show notes as well. So before we wrap up, anything else you want to share? Any last words of wisdom?
No, I just want to thank you for this opportunity to share. I don't have it all together. It's like it's a journey, but I think the most important thing is, and I think it was kind of drilled in my head as well. You remember David Kuperreiter saying we sort of organizations and I think humans as well sort of move in the direction of the things we talk about. So I think we talk about all the things that are going wrong in the world today, but there's so many great things that are happening. And I think if we can just pause and give appreciation to those things and sort of move in that direction, I think it'll help us all move out of this kind of liminal space that we're in into where we need to be in the future.
Yeah, that's a great way to end, right? That we move in the direction of what we focus on and talk about. And Tony, thank you so much. Just thank you so much for being here and sharing all of your experiences and what you've learned along the way. I just really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bobby. It's been a pleasure.
I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I was scribbling notes the whole time as there were so many pearls of wisdom, and that's what Tony always delivers. So among my favorites. 1, during times of uncertainty, we can find clarity if we seek it. 2, once you know who you are, everything else becomes clear. 3, you can do anything and do it better with a community of people. 4, everything belongs. We may not understand it at the time, but everything somehow belongs. 5, an experience can tell you what you don't want. 6, listen to hear, not to just respond. 7, don't jump into the conversation unless you are going to shift it. 8, being nervous is healthy as it forces us to be creative. 9, everyone has a story. And when you take the time to really hear someone else's story, you feel closer to that person. It's such a great way to connect. And 10, from David Kuperreiter, our professor at Case, people move and grow in the direction of what we talk about. If you found this podcast helpful, please consider subscribing as well as leaving us a 5-star review below. Also, if you know someone who could benefit from the podcast and the message that we are spreading, please tell them about it. This has been the Unyielded Podcast, and I believe that thriving is not a destination. It is a process, an evolution where we are continuing to expand who we are. It's how we flourish and how we can direct our energy into a place of positive influence. My life's work is to change the world for the better, one life at a time. I hope that you'll help me do that by sharing the word.